compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
Hello, good morning, and welcome back to the Patrick Madrid Show. I hope you enjoyed your 21-hour break, and we'll get right back to it. Those of you who are regulars of the program, you know how it works. You call 888-914-9149, and we get you on the air. If you have a comment or question, or you disagree, or you thought you'd not sure if you heard something on the show, or you have an idea, need a third opinion, second opinion, whatever it may be, I'm here for you. 888-914-9149. That number, by the way, sponsored by Catholic Order of Foresters. So we've been talking a little bit here and there over the last few days about the Harrison Butker speech. I mean, talk about a gift to Benedictine College. I mean, they are now so on the map. If anyone didn't hear about them or hadn't heard about them before the commencement ceremony and the speech that Harrison Butker gave, they certainly know where it is now. At the very least, they know what it is. And so I take the whole thing as a sort of gift to Benedictine College. And that's great. Good for them. Happy to hear that. Everybody has an opinion on this issue. It's interesting. I called it last week a Rorschach test in how people respond to this speech. And I responded to a particular part of the speech. I was focused, when I spoke about it last week, I was focused specifically on his message to young women to definitely consider marriage and family, marriage and children, etc. We've talked about that. We don't have to go back through it. But I said my piece on it. Everybody seems to have said their piece on it. People are still talking about it. And I received a very thoughtful email from, I don't know, I presume this is a woman, and the name is Junie, so I'm presuming that this is a woman's name. Forgive me if I'm mistaken on that. And I thought this was a very thoughtful, different way of looking at the bigger picture surrounding this story. Junie says, thank you for taking time to read my email. I appreciate it. I would like to add a different perspective on the Harrison Butker speech. I think we need to offer a word of caution to women when we encourage them to become homemakers. We live in a world where half of all marriages fail. Of those failed marriages, the women who served as the homemaker often need to re-enter the workplace to support themselves once their marriage dissolves. Generally, they are unskilled, inexperienced, and even uneducated. They are forced into menial, poorly paying jobs. Divorce can be financially devastating for a housewife. So I think we need to be careful when we recommend that women become housewives. I'm going to pause there for just a moment, and then I'll continue, Junie. I too have seen these sort of, I don't know whether they're pseudo statistics or just gross generalities that half of all marriages fail. That would depend on a number of factors. What age range are we talking about? There are certain factors that would play into this. So I question that as to whether or not it's in fact true that half of all marriages fail. I don't think that's true. I've heard that generalization before, but I don't think it's true. It may be true in some subsets, but I don't think it's true across the board. Continuing, even more frustrating, she says, is that the divorced man, as the wage earner, generally can eventually move on and start a whole new family with a younger woman, while his first middle-aged wife struggles to support herself and her children on an insufficient alimony/child support payment. That's valid. That's a valid point. May not be true of everybody, but it's certainly valid, and I have seen that happen. Also, Junie says, let me add that I love Relevant Radio, and I listen exclusively to Relevant Radio, but sometimes I think I hear a lot of anti-feminist statements. I'll pause there. Well, I think I would be guilty as charged on that point. I am highly critical of feminism in the typical forms that you encounter it in society. I'd be happy to talk at length about specifics if you're interested. But to just put it in one way, the war against men and the war between women and men as a social construct, I witnessed it as an adolescent and then a high schooler in the 1970s. Now, yes, I know it got going in the late 1960s and in some ways even perhaps before that. But I witnessed it. I witnessed it sort of come into full bloom. And it has been very destructive as a social force. And I wouldn't be surprised, I'd love to see some studies, but I wouldn't be surprised if the ravaging effects of feminism are in themselves responsible for a lot of the misery that exists in post-divorce situations. And we can talk about feminism if you want, but in any case, I would say I'm guilty as charged on that point. I don't favor feminism in most forms. Some people say, yeah, but Patrick, what about the feminism that Pope John Paul II created and the feminine mystique and the feminine genius? I'm not talking about that. I'm not talking about Mulieribus Dignitatis from Pope Paul VI or what Pope John Paul II had to say. I would say those are valid expositions of the true role of women in society. I'm talking about the secular, destructive, pitting men against women mindset that has poisoned so much of both men and women. I think it's been a kind of poison. So forgive me for saying guilty as charged, but yes, I am anti-feminist in that sense, the destructive, radical feminism that has caused so much damage. Continuing, this concerns me, Junie says, because I never want us to go back to life as it was in the 70s, where women's career choices were limited to teacher or nurse, where women earned 70 cents to every dollar a man earned, where women were passed over for promotions because it was assumed that they would marry and leave the workforce, where women's sports are underfunded and under-celebrated, and where young girls were taught that their face was their fortune rather than their character. I'll pause there. All valid points. I certainly don't want to live in a society where women do not make equal pay for the same job. I mean, it's fundamentally unfair. It's unjust. And no, I mean, of course we don't want to do that. But there is a way to course correct and to flush out of the system some of the toxic excesses of feminism without going to what you're describing here as an overtly inequitable situation between men and women in the workplace. So I'm with you on those things. And there's one more point I'd like to add, Junie says. I think, she says, that Harrison Butker probably should have spent less time addressing women and much more time addressing men about being holy, chaste, and faithful. I think in today's world, godly men are more lacking than women who want to marry and have children. Well, I don't know the answer to that last part because who knows? I don't know whether there are fewer godly men, however we define that term, or fewer godly women. Somebody can do a study on that. But I do agree with you. I think in retrospect, his speech could have had even more force and probably would have riled the people on the left even more so. But I do agree with you. That is a valid point. And, you know, you can't take back what's already happened. But if he had it to do all over again, I wonder if maybe that might be an add-on that he would have put into the speech, addressing the men directly. Look, you guys, you have to be holy, chaste, faithful, good men, not afraid of hard work, etc. So I'll leave it at that. I do agree with you on that point. And she concludes by saying, I thank you again for taking time to hear my perspective. If you read this on the show, please keep me anonymous. Well, sorry about that. I don't think people will be able to track you down because we don't know where you live. And that was a pseudonym that you gave. So thank you. I appreciate that. And I would say on the whole, I generally concur with you. And I appreciate you giving a different way of looking at things. And the thing that really sticks with me, Cyrus, I don't know if you have an opinion on this issue, but you and I both have kicked this around. Ha ha, no joke. You know, I recognize he's a kicker for the football team. But I think that there's something there that's really valuable in terms of maybe even amplifying Harrison Butker's message, at least on the topic. And I'm not talking about all the other things he discussed, but specifically the glories of marriage and fulfillment that comes from having a family, getting married and having a family. Now that she puts it that way, I guess I do see the point that there could have been just as much said to the men about the men, don't you think?
I don't know. It's kind of like someone telling you, like when you're going off about something and then you get an email or a phone call, it's like, well, but Patrick, yeah, why didn't you mention this?
You failed to mention this. That's true. But I mean, okay, so in retrospect, though, I think that could have been a good thing. This is not a criticism of that part of his speech. I mean, I think he was on target with the point that he made in that category. But it could have been even more effective if he said, you know, guys, I'm talking to you right now. So just some thoughts, and I'm glad that you sent me that email. Thank you for that. Let's go to Ryan. Is it Ryan or Rain? I don't know which, in Nashville.
Ryan.
Ryan. Hello, Ryan.
Can you hear me okay?
Yeah.
Okay, great. So my dad is a Protestant. I am Catholic. And we go toe-to-toe on some of the issues pretty frequently.
Okay.
And one that he brought up recently was about the Eucharist, because he reads John 6, and he just doesn't understand how we get the Eucharist out of that. The one that he specifically brought up to me was verse 63, which he reads as refuting pretty much everything Jesus had said before. So I just wanted to hear your thoughts on that, because I didn't have a great answer for him off the top of my head.
Yeah, it is the Spirit that gives life. The flesh is of no avail. The words that I have spoken to you are spirit and in life. Yes, this is not an uncommon rejoinder from Protestants. So the thing to point out is the word flesh can be understood in a variety of ways. And in this case, it's referring to a worldly mindset, the flesh with all of its unruly appetites. He's not saying my body, my flesh is of no avail, because if that were true, then his death on the cross would have been no avail, because his body was killed. I mean, he himself died, his body and soul separated. So you can just simply turn this back around and say, well, if you think that John 6:63 somehow undoes the force of all the things that came before, where Jesus says, my flesh is real food, my blood is real drink, he who eats my flesh and drinks my blood abides in me and I in him. And he just keeps saying this repeatedly to the point where a good section of his followers just, they check out. Like, we can't listen to this anymore, because they realized he was speaking in some manner in a literal way that they couldn't accept. They knew he wasn't speaking metaphorically or symbolically, because if they did understand him that way, there'd be no reason to leave. So in verse 66, in verse 63, he's not saying flesh in terms of my body. He's saying flesh as in your fleshly mind, your fleshly mindset. The spirit, in other words, I'm teaching you a truth that is spiritual. This is coming from me, God. And if you, in your secular, fleshly, human, limited, appetite-driven way, if you think that's what I'm talking about, no, that's not what I'm talking about. So I would propose that your father's difficulty here is simply that he's restricting the word flesh in John 6:63 to a particular meaning that it doesn't have in that context. And you can see other examples. So throughout the Pauline epistles, St. Paul talks about the war in the flesh, the war of your appetites. You know, he knows what's right, but his body wants to do what's wrong, part of the human condition. A worldly, fleshly mindset. And that word, sarx, which is the Greek word for flesh, it can mean that. It can also mean the actual body with the flesh and bones. So there's a variety of meanings, and he's misunderstanding what it means in this context. That's what I would say if I were talking to him.
Got it. Well, thank you very much. I had told him that I didn't have a great answer, but I would just call into the show and then probably just send him the clip afterwards so he could hear it.
Sure.
So essentially, essentially what you're saying is Jesus is doubling down again in verse 63, rather than just saying, you know, it's not food that's going to save you. It's specifically his flesh, which is
right.
Spiritual.
Yeah. So I think if we want to, you know, not put too fine a point on it, come back to the cross. Jesus's flesh suffered and died on the cross. If his flesh is of no avail, in other words, if everything he said in John chapter 6, the bread of life discourse, my flesh is real food, my blood is real drink, he who eats my flesh and drinks my blood has life within him, and all of those things. If that doesn't really mean that, because John 6:63 obviates that in essence is saying, yeah, my body doesn't have any avail whatsoever, then how would your dad, I mean, with all due respect to him, how would he explain the efficacy of the crucifixion? How can Jesus shed blood on the cross in any way avail anything for us if, in John 6:63, he applies that meaning there. I mean, you can't have it both ways.
Yeah, so that makes if, sense.
Yeah, yeah. So if Jesus' suffering and death on the cross did win the victory, if by his atoning death on the cross he did not only atone but save those who will be saved, if his actual suffering and death in his body accomplished that, then I don't see how he could maintain the opposite in John 6:63.
Okay, great. That is extremely helpful, Patrick.
I'm glad. Okay, well, my greetings and salutations to your father. I hope that he finds this discussion interesting. 888-914-9149. Let's go to Don in Chicago. Hello, Don.
Morning.
Did he just fall down?
Yeah, I can't. Sounds like he just fell down or fell off your chair, Don. How about this? It sounds like you're not quite ready yet. We'll take a quick timeout and we'll come back to you. Have the phone off of speaker, have it ready to roll, and I'll come back to you straight away right after this quick timeout. Today, we'd like to thank Felicia, who's listening in Tennessee, for donating her 2004 Chevrolet Express Classic. You can join thousands of other listeners in donating old vehicles, trucks, boats, and RVs by visiting relevantradio.com/car. That's relevantradio.com/car.
Real life solutions you can believe in. This is the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
Okay, we are back. Yes, by the music, you can tell it's Taco Tuesday. Happy Taco Tuesday. Let's see. We're going to go back to you, Don, in Chicago. Good morning and welcome.
Morning. I was just calling to see if you had ever heard of the St. Joseph Rosary. I'm a Catholic my whole life. I've already sort of what I would call the regular Rosary to Mother Mary. Mm-hmm. But I just recently heard that there's a St. Joseph Rosary and the St. Joseph Chaplet. I was wondering if you knew about them or the history of them or what the difference between the chaplet and the rosary was.
Well, I'm not deeply familiar with it. I have heard about it, and I know it's a devotion that's been around for quite some time, you know, maybe, I don't know, 300-400 years, something like that. And it's a devotion to St. Joseph that uses a rosary as a way to offer prayers to the Lord in honor of St. Joseph. So I've seen them before. I know that they use typically either a modified rosary, or it could even be prayed on a rosary itself. The easiest thing to do would be just look it up. You know, look it up on Google, I suppose. But if you're looking for, like, when was the devotion started, and I don't know those things. But I would say it's similar to, like, the green scapular or the white scapular. They're different colored scapulars. The traditional earliest one that I'm aware of anyway is the brown scapular. So there are different permutations that some people favor. They like the green scapular for health reasons or whatever. I would say this is something similar to that. Somebody got the idea, not a bad idea, but somebody got the idea, oh, well, I can deepen my devotion to St. Joseph, patron of the Universal Church, by having a form of prayer that involves him. And I'll just use the rosary to follow along. I'm pretty sure it was something like that. But who started it or when it started, I'd have to look that up too, just like you can, Don.
Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome. I wish I had something more spectacular for you, but I think a little okay. Googling will get you what you need. I appreciate the call. Thank you. 888-914-9149. Before we go on to the next phone call, I had a note come in. And I think it was, it was this morning. And this is from Meg and Joe. And they're listening on the Relevant Radio app. I don't know where, but hello, Meg and Joe. To Patrick Madrid, an AI site generated this poem for you per our request. Here goes. Ready? Strap in, Cyrus. Voices echo across the airwaves. Patrick Madrid's wisdom shared, a radio beacon in a world of noise, guiding souls with words that care. In the hush of midnight's embrace, truth unfurls its wings to fly, illuminating hearts in seeking grace, On the waves of faith they will alight. Listen closely to the whispers profound. I should have said that. Listen closely to the whispers profound. As Patrick Madrid's radio resounds. Hey, that rhymes. That's pretty good. Thank you, Meg and Joe. Very thoughtful of you. Did you write all that down, Cyrus?
No, but I thought it needed a music bed.
Winchester Cathedral. I'm trying to get the connection. What's the connection?
Nope, just happy music.
Okay. Yeah, Winchester Cathedral. This was popular on the radio when I was a kid. Well, that's thoughtful of you, Meg and Joe. We did a few of our own. I think we did some limericks or something like that on AI going back a year or so ago, Cyrus. We'll have to try to dust those off.
Those are fun. I asked some AI. I saw that email come through, and I was like, all right, we can have fun with that. So
yeah.
I asked some AI to give me some Patrick Madrid poems.
Okay.
After making sure
ears.
Knew who you were first. But with
AI said who? And you said Google it, and then it came back to you and said, what?
What?
Yeah.
Oh, Patrick, the man of the mic, with a voice so smooth like a fine Merlot, he shares his thoughts and stories galore.
I like the wine reference.
I thought you would. But sometimes he can be a bit of a bore.
Oh.
His love for the Beatles.
I hate this AI. This is funny. Go ahead.
His love for the Beatles, it knows no bounds. He strums his bass with a joyful sound. But if he starts to sing, beware, for his voice may clear the room like
you're
air.
You're not an AI algorithm. You wrote this.
That's good enough. Yeah. Silly AI.
Silly AI. Well, we'll have to do so. You know, it would be fun.
Why here's to you, dear Patrick, a man of faith and wit, a Catholic man. We'll keep on listening with laughter and cheer to the Patrick Madrid Show year after year.
Oh, I like that. Well, it ended well. In the middle, it got a little wobbly, but it ended well. I think it'd be fun to have a listener Patrick Madrid Show AI limerick contest or something like that. That'd be fun. And then read the winners on the air. We did that actually some years ago, before your time, Cyrus. And we did a listener limerick contest, and we got, I don't know, 30, 40 different entries, and then we read the top three on the air. People seem to enjoy that. Who knows? Maybe we'll do something like that again. 888-914-9149.
I just asked AI to do a limerick, so I have not read this. Oh, it's way too long. It's still going. Never mind. Never
oh,
mind.
Oh, it's still cranking.
It's still, yeah, it's way too many lines.
All right. I have an email here from Anonymous in Pittsburgh about Marian consecration. Patrick, please speak about Marian consecration. I've been working through 33 Days to Morning Glory by Father Gately. Some of the attributes he gives Mary almost make her seem like God. I am having difficulty with this and would appreciate your thoughts. Thank you. Okay, well, I'll put it this way. I, too, recognize in some of the writings of earlier towering figures in the church, people like St. Louis de Montfort, St. Maximilian Kolbe, to name two, whose writings about Our Lady are, in my estimation, and it's just my own opinion, I have a right to my opinion, this is my opinion, take it or leave it, they're overly florid and it can come across exaggerated in such a way that people who are not properly catechized could easily stumble over them and could easily think that the Catholic Church is teaching a, you know, let's say a worship of Mary. I saw something pop up on social media recently where, you know, somebody was saying, yeah, we do worship Mary, and you crazy Catholic apologists, you stop telling people we don't worship Mary, because it was a misunderstanding of the use of the word worship in a papal pronouncement. Worship has, in English at least, an older meaning than we use it now. We use it now, worship, as a synonym for adoration, what a creature owes to the Creator, things of that nature. And it had an earlier meaning that was broader than what we currently use it for. And it meant to honor and to give special veneration to. And it was distinct. There are actually two Greek words, and I'm going to come back to the essence of your question in a moment. But this is where this online pundit got it all wrong, because he was adamantly telling other people, you shouldn't say that we don't worship Mary because we do. And look right here, Pope so-and-so said that we worship Mary. Yeah, you got it wrong, buddy. The term worship in that context is referring to the dulia that we give to God's saints. Dulia in the Greek is a special veneration. Hyperdulia is the sort of ultimate type of veneration that we give to the Blessed Virgin Mary. She is a creature. We don't worship her in the modern sense of the term. We only worship God. And it shouldn't have to be said, but apparently it does. The other term in Greek is latria. That means worship, the worship that a creature gives to God. And the Pope was not using the term as it's translated into English in that sense. He was using it in the second sense, the first one that I just mentioned, the type of special veneration. So back to your question, Anonymous. I do find that there are some things, St. Alphonsus Liguori and his The Glories of Mary, in some places so far over the top in his description that could, if you're really careful and nuanced and you make lots of qualifications, it could be understood within the broader category of orthodoxy, Catholic orthodoxy. But the average person doesn't bring that to the table. Like this guy on Twitter, he didn't bring those tools to the table, so he misunderstood the meaning of the word worship in that context. And I'd say that's probably true of most people, the vast majority maybe. So if you're reading some of these things and it's ascribing attributes to Mary, or it's saying things like, you know, I give everything to Mary and I trust that God will do everything he wants to do to me through her, that goes beyond what the church actually teaches about Mary. So the Marian dogmas of the faith, there are four of them. And that goes beyond what the church has said. And that's why I think you're having this kind of confusion. So my advice would be, when you read an otherwise fine book like 33 Days to Morning Glory, it's wildly popular. I don't know how many gazillions of copies it sold, but it's a good thing to develop your relationship with the Blessed Virgin Mary, as it says in the Holy Bible in 1 Corinthians chapter 12, no member of the body can say to any other member of the body, I do not need you. So in recognizing the glory that God has given to her, as we read about Jesus saying in John chapter 17, Father, I have given them the glory you have given to me. When we acknowledge that, when we properly and rightfully venerate the great things that the Lord has done in his saints by his grace, especially with the Blessed Virgin Mary, that's a good thing, biblically based. It's grounded solidly in biblical theology. But the point is, if it's taken too far, it can begin to suggest things that are not in keeping with biblical truth and the truth of the apostolic tradition. So that would be my advice to you. Or as the Bible says, test all things, hold fast to that which is good. And if you're reading a section where it seems to be a little exaggerated or florid, just skip over it, and I think you'll be fine, knowing that that's not the way in which maybe a theologian might put it, especially in a situation where you've got poorly catechized lay people and Protestant folk and others who just definitely don't understand that at face value. Thank you. Speaking of which, I have a feeling, Edward in Pennsylvania, you may be the one who wrote that email to me on line 3. Good morning, Edward.
Yes, you're exactly right.
I wondered, because it would have been too much of a coincidence for you to be asking the same question on the show.
I was surprised when I just came back from talking to your producer, your call screener, and then here you're answering the question that I was going to ask.
So did that hit the spot? Is there more about it that you wanted to ask?
But it did hit the spot, but I have a corollary question, and it's more probably highlights my own deficit in being catechized. But your previous conversation with the man that was, you know, trying to distinguish between flesh in one context and flesh in another context.
Right.
It is just so hard, Patrick, for me. I've been trying to reinvigorate my commitment to Jesus, but I have such difficulty with just what scripture and you have to make all these nuances between this and that. And I mean, I'm still working full time. I have a family. I'm a grandfather. Mm-hmm. I don't have time to be a biblical scholar. You know, I just if you could just speak to that a little bit, I'd appreciate it.
Sure, sure. So let me begin by saying that's why God invented people like Scott Hahn. He is a Bible scholar, and so he can do all that hard work and heavy lifting and put it into a book form or, you know, a CD. I mean, people don't have CDs anymore, but you know what I mean. He can distill those things in a way that makes it accessible for the average person. So there are resources that can help with this, but remember, too, that it's important to grow your mind, obviously, to grow your storehouse of knowledge of the truth. That's a lifelong task for all of us. But, I mean, I freely acknowledge I couldn't build a house. I don't know how. I don't know the first thing about, like, electrical wiring or plumbing. I mean, I can hire people who can do that, but I know that I can't do that. I know that I can't, you know, play the violin or do many. I couldn't pilot an airliner. I mean, there's so many things that I can't do, but I rely on the people who can do them, and that's just fine with me. And I wonder if you look at it that way, you can have a kind of a sense of peace, or you're not restless or concerned, because if that's not your life work, if you haven't learned the biblical languages and you're not steeped in the literature and the research and the scholarship, it's no wonder that you find it a little bit at times, you know, a little bit beyond what you're capable of processing. That's where we call in specialists to help us. I mean, Cyrus and I and you and all of us, we all have our strengths, but we all also have so many areas where we don't know. So I wouldn't feel bad about this. Keep pushing, keep reading, keep asking God to help you understand it more clearly. But, you know, the Bible itself says, St. Peter says that in St. Paul's writings, there are many things that are difficult and hard to understand, that the ignorant and unstable distort to their own destruction. So we see there a warning that there are things in the Bible that are difficult, and not everybody is going to belly up to the table and immediately understand them. None of us does, you know.
Right. Okay. Well, I appreciate that. I think I just need to be a little more patient, like you, I think is what partly what you're trying to say, and I appreciate it.
Yeah, and I hope this comes across to you as a form of encouragement, because the worst thing would be if you turned away from it in frustration and said, well, to heck with that, I'm not going to read the Bible anymore. No, don't do that. But when you run into difficult things, do what I do. I go consult a trustworthy concordance. I look, what did the church fathers say on this issue? What did St. Thomas say on this issue? And that helps me. And we're all in that same boat to greater or lesser extents. So sure. It's a lifelong adventure of learning and plumbing the depths. We'll never get to the depths, but we try as hard as we can to plumb the depths of biblical revelation so that we can understand it and live it more freely. It's a good thing.
As far as the concordance, is that app you've mentioned in the past, the IPATA, I think it's called?
Yeah. Well, actually, yeah, that is one. That's one resource that I've used often over the years. It's actually pronounced IPATA, but that's okay. Neither here nor there. But it has a number of concordances, the Haydock Concordance, for example. I'm also a big fan of the Catholic Commentary on Holy Scripture that was edited by Dom Bernard Orchard. That's a big, heavy tome, and I prefer to sort of read it in that form. But, I mean, whether it's on the phone, on an app, or in your library, those are really great resources. Now, that's older scholarship from the 19th and into the early 20th century. There has been really good, faithful, and orthodox biblical scholarship that we can turn to. And I mentioned Scott Hahn. I would say he would be at the forefront of that type of biblical scholarship. So that can help as well.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for your time. I appreciate it.
You're welcome. You're welcome. I hope this helps a little bit. We're going to take a break, and we'll come right back with more of the Patrick Madrid Show on the other side of this. The Marian route for the Eucharistic pilgrimage today will be in Grand Rapids at St. Joseph Catholic Church, rather. And that'll be Mass at 9 a.m. Oops, it's just about to start. Let's see. The East Route today will be at St. Matthew's Parish in Norwalk, Connecticut. And I'll give you the other couple when we come back from this break. This hour is supported by Notre Dame Federal Credit Union. Join the nation's largest Catholic-oriented credit union and receive $200 when you add a direct deposit. Learn more at NotreDameFCU.com/join. That's NotreDameFCU.com/join.
Keeping it relevant. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio. Yeah, yeah. Join the conversation at 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149. Patrick Madrid is on Coast to Coast on Relevant Radio.
I didn't mean to leave you hanging, so sorry about that. I was talking about the pilgrimage routes en route right now to Indianapolis for the National Eucharistic Congress coming up in July. Hope to see you there, by the way. So I mentioned the Marian route. They are in Grand Rapids today at St. Joseph Catholic Church. The St. Elizabeth Ann Seton route, that's the eastern route. Today they are at St. Matthew in Norwalk, Connecticut, St. Matthew's Parish. And throughout the day, they'll be moving from one location to the next. So you can find all the information out at relevantradio.com. Then the St. Juan Diego route in the south. Today they will be, and actually are right now at this very minute, gathering at the for a one-mile procession from Immaculate Heart of Mary Parish to Our Lady of the Assumption Parish in Harlingen, Texas. And let's see. And then the western route, St. Junipero Serra. They are meeting in Vallejo, on Vallejo Street, rather, in Vallejo at St. Vincent Ferrer Parish. And they'll be having Mass in, hour and a half from now. So you can follow their movements all across the country and check out more information about the National Eucharistic Congress at relevantradio.com. How about Ted now in Hawthorne, California? Good morning, Ted.
Good morning, Patrick. I had a question. I'm Catholic, married to a Protestant. I don't know if you heard about it, but they had a thing across California, Southern California, baptisms at the beach. And I was just, she told me after the fact that she had taken my son down there. She said she didn't get him baptized, but he was all wet. Mm-hmm. But I was just really curious, did you hear about that?
No. I mean, it probably was big news in those circles, but the average person outside of those circles would not likely have heard about it. So I didn't hear about it. But are you wondering if the baptisms would be valid? Let's not talk about your son quite yet. We'll come back to him in a minute. But is that part of your question?
It is. Yes, it is.
Okay. So with a couple qualifications, the answer would be yes. And the qualifications are the following. If the person who performed the baptism said the words, "I baptize you in the name of the Father and of the Son and of the Holy Spirit," while either immersing the person under the water or while pouring water over the person's head, and it was actual water, so in this case in the ocean, that's considered actual water, and if he had the intention to baptize the person in the name of the Blessed Trinity, one God in three persons, even if he doesn't understand or even agree with the Catholic Church's rich theological explanation for baptism, all other things being equal, yes, that would be a valid baptism. Now, a couple little details here. In the early church, for example, in the Didache, which is an early second century document, that is a sort of a distillation of the teaching of the 12 apostles. It wasn't written by them, but it's sort of a distillation of certain liturgical customs, including baptism. And it specifies that the water to be used for baptism should be living water. And what it means by living water is like the ocean or a river or a stream. In other words, moving water. That's the ideal kind of water. If there's no living water or moving water to be had, you can use still water. You can use water in a cistern or water in a pond that might be still. You could even use water from a pitcher, using water that is drawn from a pump or a well or something like that. But it has to be water, and seawater certainly qualifies. Now, as far as your son is concerned, if indeed, I don't mean to propose that your wife did something behind your back, but let's just say in a different universe, somebody were to do that. Well, if your son has already been baptized, this has no effect. You can only be validly baptized once. And when you're validly baptized, it's permanent and irrevocable. And there's a seal, if we want to use this analogy, like the signet ring of a king back in the olden days, who would press his ring into the hot wax that would seal the decree that he was sending out. And the way the person receiving this decree would know that it actually came from the king is that the imprint of his royal ring was found in the wax. In other words, it's sort of a transfer of the image of his ring, symbolizing his authority, into the wax itself. So this is merely an analogy, but this is what happens when you're validly baptized. The character, the imprint, or the sealing of Jesus Christ unto the soul itself, not in a physical way, of course, but that's what happens. So it can never be repeated. And so if your wife or somebody were to do that, it would have had no effect. It would be just a gesture. There may be some emotional feelings that someone might feel, but if you're baptized validly once, no matter how many times you try to go through it again, none of them actually do anything. Do you see what I mean, Ted?
Yeah, I do. That's what I was afraid of, because you know they haven't been to Holy Communion or anything like that, and I wanted them to go through the RCIA program, but in that case, I mean, they would baptize them again if they went through that program, wouldn't they?
Right. Yeah, because, see, here's the thing. Within evangelical Protestantism, there's a heavy influence from the Anabaptist movement, or Baptists, as they're known nowadays. And Baptists, they utterly deny the efficacy of the sacrament of baptism. They say it's just an outward symbol. It's just a sign. It's just an ordinance. Now, we do it, they say, out of respect for and obedience to Jesus, because he said to do it. But they would say it has no causal effect on the soul. It doesn't do anything. Therefore, under that scheme, they see no reason why not to get baptized repeatedly. If you, let's say you go through some life event and you backslide into terrible sin and you want to get right with God again, well, in that world, they would say, well, come and get baptized. Well, I already was baptized. Yeah, come and get baptized again, because for them, it's a way of showing in an outward way the inward change of heart, you see. So that's why things like this are so common in evangelical Protestantism, at least in the United States, because of the heavy influence of the Baptist way of looking at this.
Wow. Okay.
Now, you seem troubled. You seem troubled. Is your son an adult? Is he a child? Was he raised Catholic? Was he ever baptized?
So I have three kids, and one's 12, one's 10, and none of them, and one's 8. But she did have one of my oldest son baptized in the church, in her church. And I went and whatever. I didn't like it. She just kind of, you know.
Was it a baptism in the name of the Father and of the Son and of the Holy Spirit while being immersed in water, or water poured over the head? More likely the former. Is that
what
happened?
Yeah, it was. Mm-hmm.
Okay. So that would be, ostensibly, there's no reason to think it's not, but that would be a valid baptism.
Yeah, and I by listening to you and what I know, that, yeah, it was a valid baptism. But I didn't like it because, you know, I want the kids to be baptized by a priest.
Right.
So when she did that, yes, she did that Sunday. Like I said, she told me she didn't do it, but like I said, he was all wet when I did see him. Mm-hmm. But she said she wouldn't do it. She wouldn't have done that. But my marriage is hanging by a thread, so I just really wouldn't put anything past her if she did or if she didn't. But it does bother me that she does do that. I was under the assumption that when people get married, that the children usually take on the dad's religion, not the mother's.
When you and your wife were married, Were you married in a Catholic church, even though she's a Protestant?
We weren't. It was the same type of thing, pastor on the beach type thing.
Okay. Yeah. And you yourself are a Catholic. You were raised Catholic, or at the very least, you were baptized and confirmed and received your first communion at some point?
Yes, I'm Catholic, you know, okay. A practicing Catholic.
Okay, that's good.
So I just,
now, is your... Oh, go ahead, Ted, sorry. Yeah.
I want my kids to be Catholic, just for so many different reasons. And when they're of age, then if they choose to go that other route, then it's on them. But I feel like, you know, it's my duty as a father to get them to be confirmed in the Catholic Church. I would feel more of a man, more of a father, if I'm able to do that for them. Because as everybody who knows who is a Catholic, how it's a wonderful place to, I think just being Catholic is a wonderful place to be.
Not to mention that it's the church that Jesus established nearly 2,000 years ago. So there's that.
And that's, and that as well. And I always get a kick out of when you say, coming to the Catholic Church, the water's terrible or something like that. And I think that's hilarious. But,
hilarious but in a kind of sad but true way, isn't it?
Yeah. But that's where I'm at. That's why you kind of, like you mentioned, I'm just real not excited about it. Or I am troubled about mm-hmm. that.
You might want to give your wife a copy of a book called Surprised by Truth, if you think she'd read it. It's a compendium of conversion testimonies by former evangelical Protestants who became Catholic. And they just tell their stories in a very real and powerful way. There's something unique about those stories. It's the first volume. It has a red cover. I edited this book back in 1994, but that has no bearing on this issue because you'll be reading their testimonies. But I can tell you, Ted, countless instances of people like your wife who had like sudden conversions to the Catholic faith by reading that book. So if you've tried everything and nothing works and you just can't get her attention, this is something you could try. Maybe read a chapter together each night as a couple, you know, or if the kids are old enough to be there, read it with them there too.
I like it. I'm that's perfect. I am going to take that advice because I have nothing else to go by. I have nothing else. I'm at my wit's end. So that might just be, what the doctor prescribed for sure.
Wouldn't that be great? Well, you can buy a used copy for peanuts online. I mean, I'm not trying to sell you a book. I'm not looking for any benefit to me. I'm just mentioning that I edited this book, but I can tell you, I don't have time to tell you, just the countless stories of dramatic, grace-filled, even miraculous conversions of people who read that book and were like, oh my gosh, I got to become Catholic. So it's worth looking into. Anyway, so you want the one, it says, Surprised by Truth, 11 converts give the biblical and historical reasons for becoming Catholics. You want to look for the one that says 11 converts, because there's Surprised by Truth 2 that I think has 15, Surprised by Truth 3 that has 10 or something like that. You want the one that says 11 converts. That's the one I would give her.
Gotcha. Okay, perfect.
All right. Hang in there, man. Hang in there.
Thanks, Patrick. Pleasure as always.
Thank you to you too. And who knows, maybe we'll get Ted's wife to start listening to the program too. Wouldn't that be great? Caden in West Jordan, Utah. Thank you for your patience and welcome.
Hey, Patrick. So I just have a bit of a two-parter question. So one is, when does anger become a mortal sin? And then two would be, is losing your temper and yelling at your young kids a mortal sin?
No. So let's start with the grounds for mortal sin. The act itself has to be grave matter. And yelling at your kids because they're driving you crazy is not grave matter. The intention has to be that you intend to do something that you know is seriously wrong and God has forbidden it and you do it anyway. And so that doesn't occur in this case either if you're yelling at your kids. Often that's just something that you don't even have control over. You just lose your patience and you shout at them to be quiet. Isn't it funny that we shout at our kids, tell them to be quiet? And so the object of the act itself is not grave matter, and you're not looking at this and saying, I know this is a serious sin and God doesn't want me to do this, but I'm going to do it anyway. So you could dismiss that as a concern. Now, it could be a venial sin. It could be a fault or an imperfection that you'd have to work on if it's inordinate, if it goes beyond just being a good dad and moderating your kid's behavior. That's important, but it could become excessive. Now, if you're so furious with your kids that you're beating them with a stick, that would be a mortal sin, sure. I mean, you could go deeper into that kind of sin, but what you just described doesn't sound like anything like that. So then the other part, when does anger become a mortal sin? When the desire to have retribution and punishment and harm and even worse things, like you want to kill somebody, that's when it could go into the category of wrath, which St. Thomas says is one of the seven deadly sins. So anger is one thing, and we all experience it. In fact, there's a kind of anger that is good and necessary. Righteous anger would be what we call it. But if it goes beyond that where you want to destroy, that's where you're heading into mortal sin territory. Thanks, Katie.